Hello, this is The Schwepp. The secret is your Western esotericism podcast. I'm Earl Fontenelle, and today I have the pleasure of welcoming back to The Schwepp Jonathan Gregg, who is now a postdoctoral researcher on the project Visions of the History of Greek Philosophy in Late Antiquity and the Arabic and Greek Middle Ages at the Humboldt University Berlin, but is also more generally just someone who's really deep into the meshing of philosophy and theology in what are often called the sort of early Byzantine centuries, late antiquity in the Eastern Mediterranean. Jonathan, it's a pleasure to have you back on the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you again for inviting me here.
My pleasure. We're talking about Maximus the Confessor today. Now, this guy, if you just go to Wikipedia and find out the basics of him, he seems to be a hugely respected theologian in all camps, right? So what will eventually develop into Roman Catholicism love him and think he's a legit father. The Eastern Orthodox tradition, of course, loves him and thinks he's a legit father. He's hugely influential, widely read, but also ran into a spot of bother and was sort of, you know, when you go one level deeper, he was absolutely embroiled in theological controversy in his life. His life is very interesting. So maybe the first thing to start with, before we even get to why he's interesting from the perspective of the history of Western esotericism, which I believe he very much is, let's just get a basic run through of his life, maybe emphasize like what bits are certain, what we can say for certain, what we can't say for certain, you know, what the limitations are, what the open questions are about this guy.
I think the issue with Maximus is in some ways similar to who's the identity of the pseudo-Dionysius. Of course, we have, you know, obviously a different case here, the identity, but Maximus's origin, that's still a very open, I think, question. There is some consensus now that we have a Palestinian origin with Maximus, but basically we have two lives of Maximus. So there's the Greek life of Maximus, and there were three different recensions of this one life, and there's still some question mark, basically, of how to reconcile these different recensions. There still isn't really a critical edition of that text as it is. And even then, that has its own issues for the origins. So we have the Greek life of Maximus, and there's the Syriac life of Maximus, which was from the side of Maximus's opponents. So it has a lot more of a polemical undertone.
Right.
But that does give us some more interesting details that aligns more closely with other things, namely Maximus's association with this Sophronius, Patriarch of Jerusalem, from I think it was the 630s or 640s, if I remember right. And that's basically, it was from Sophronius that we have the first opposition to the position of monothelitism. So the claim that Christ had only one will between his divine and human natures instead of two wills, that was position Sophronius and then Maximus defends. But basically between the Greek life and the Syriac life, at least what we can generally gather between those and then the other documents is probably he had his origin somewhere around 580. At some points he came to North Africa, then to Rome. And then this was, of course, at this point in defending the diophilite position, so the position that Christ had two wills. Maximus came to Pope Theodore I and then Martin I around like probably the 630s, mid-630s or 640s, I think. And then the controversy sort of kind of got going from around 648, I think, when Paul II, who's the Patriarch of Constantinople, between 641 to 654, banned speaking of one or two wills in his typos publication.
Am I right in thinking that this might have been a political directive that's being passed down from the emperor? Like we have enough trouble to worry about with these Muslims rampaging all over the place at this stage in the 640s.
Exactly.
So shut up about how many wills Christ had for the moment. Is that kind of what's going on? Or is that a reasonable interpretation?
At that point, definitely. Yeah. One of the big things is the emperor is pushing very much, trying to hold the line again up for a common position, reconciling the empire against these invaders coming from North Africa, the Persian Empire, and then the early Islamic invasions. So that's definitely massively pushing in the background.
So this is the Emperor Heraclius, for context, right? Like who's probably the first, since Justinian, the most important, longest reigning emperor of Eastern Rome. He rules from 610 to 641. So he sees basically this massive war with the Sasanians that the Romans almost lose. Then the Romans get Jerusalem back. And then just as they're about to kind of celebrate, these Arabs show up. And again, you know, Rome almost collapses and huge amounts of territory are gobbled up. So there's our context. So Maximus is living through all this stuff, right?
Yeah. And despite the political pressure and the theological pressure to try to come up with some unification or some way of reconciling with the Monophysites, so that side of the church that had split off, holding that Christ had one nature instead of two natures, against the Nestorians, saying that, you know, there are two hypostases instead of one hypostasis, the Chalcedonian position. So the compromise was, okay, well, maybe we can throw a bone to these Monophysites and say Christ has one. At first, it started the monergist position, that Christ had one energeia, one activity, or one operation. It started as that, and then at some point switched to the monotheli position, that Christ had one will or faculty of will, not just activity. In some ways, maybe a stronger way to formulate the position. And despite that, yeah, so that was one, like, probably the one way that the emperor and then the Constantinopolitan patriarchs were trying to reconcile with the Monophysite churches. And, well, of course, Maximus being the ardent, and also Sophronius in that camp, being the ardent gadflies that they were not that happy with that.
And so they didn't want to compromise, basically. They were like, shut up about your politics. Yeah. We want to know about Christ's nature. And that's
exactly
what matters. Okay.
Yeah. So in this milieu, in this background, these odd monastics, they are kind of weird guys in that sense from this period. Even after Maximus's death, when you get to the Sixth Ecumenical Council in 580, 581, when Maximus' position is ultimately affirmed with the two wills, he's not named, for example. And I forget, I don't know if Sophronius was also named in that, but it's clear even in that atmosphere, the name of Maximus is still a controversy for people,
right,
even for the church. And so that's something that they're still kind of silently trying to sideline while basically conceding ultimately to the thing he was fighting for. But until that point, and even after then, he was quite an outlier politically, and well within the church politics too, as well as the general empire.
Yeah, it's interesting to try to reconstruct his life, because he's traveling around in the just about to fracture East Roman Empire. So the East Roman Empire has reconquered North Africa under Justinian. He's traveling around in those territories, right? But they're about to just be gone forever to Arab invaders. Egypt is the same situation. He traveled to Rome, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So there's in this period, there's still huge amounts of communication between Rome and Constantinople, even though Rome is sort of awash in a sea of post-Roman Empire Germanic politics. But there's already a lot of headbutting going on between the Pope and the authorities at Constantinople, right? So that's, I mean, if one
that also happens
super deep into the theological controversies, you have to factor that in. Sometimes popes are coming to Constantinople and then being put under house arrest. There's all manner of shenanigans going on. How does he die? And let's draw his short biography to a close, and then maybe we can come back and talk about some of the philosophical and theological issues here. He runs into a spot of bother, right? Is it true that he ends up having his hand cut off?
There's different testimonia. I mean, it's certain basically he had, he definitely received pretty severe punishments. So, I mean, I've not really read that much on the literature, but I mean, his tongue cut off and his right hand cut. So basically the means by which he could write and then speak. And this was after, I think, three or so meetings between the Constantinopolitan patriarch at that point, Constans II. Three meetings, they tried to persuade him otherwise from speaking and talking. And it was after the third meeting, after his first or second jail, I think, where he was jailed. Then that was after the third meeting, then they were like, okay, we've had enough of this guy. Around, I think, 658, around 662, basically, that was his final trial. And then shortly afterwards, he dies of his injuries in the fortress of Skymarus, which is somewhere basically in Georgia, close to the Black Sea, I think.
Right. So they sort of send him out of the way, send him out into the Commonwealth of Orthodox countries, but not in the empire anymore, and he dies.
Yeah. not far enough away from danger for them. So that's, yeah.
So let me ask you this. He's run into, obviously, ecclesiastical censure, seemingly backed by political censure, because the church doesn't really have political power in itself to do things like chop someone's hand off. They have to kind of get the authorities in, the secular arm, as it were, to come and do these sorts of things. Can you summarize why he's controversial? Because he's an ardent supporter of the Chalcedonian Orthodox tradition, right?
Yeah.
His whole point is that he's super Orthodox. He's like 100% on the side of Constantinople in theory, but in practice, there's one point or a few points on which he just will not compromise that they don't like. Is that the situation?
Yeah, although I think he would put it more as, if you take these positions, regardless of the identity of whoever supported it, then these things follow. I think from the other side, from the patriarch sides, they take more of that, if Constantinople maintained the Chalcedonian position, that means political unity, monothelitism, basically. And I think, like, how they frame it, maybe that's a little hypothetical, but I think both sides play the Chalcedonian cards, but on the one side it's, there's a broad political consensus, and I think the way that you see Maximus talking about these things in the text, it's a lot more that theologically this is what follows, regardless of whatever these people think.
Right.
But he very much just follows like the logic, as he sees or as he argues it, to the point where, I mean, there is kind of one well-known case where his earlier writings, one example, he disagrees with himself like at one point. Like the one famous example is his earlier writings. He affirms that Christ had gnomic will as well as a natural will. Basic distinction between the two. The natural will is sort of the rational appetitive faculty, like, for example, the desire for hunger, for thirst, for ends that basically like align with fulfilling one's nature effectively, or that belongs to nature. And then the gnomic will would be the desiderative faculty, the faculty for calculating the means to that ends. So initially, his position was, if Christ was human, then it seems to just normally follow you from the gnomic will, like everyone has with the natural will. Then in his later writings, when he comes to bring that together with, if Christ's already in his human nature, so his human nature is united with his divine nature, that means he must have perfect knowledge, even if it has a human development, but still, like, he already has a knowledge of the goods as such, thanks to his divine nature and the communion of properties between the two natures. And then a fortiori, if you affirm the gnomic will, that would actually imply that individual doesn't have perfect knowledge. If you have perfect knowledge, you would already know the means, and you wouldn't have to to deliberate between different ends because there's one thing. So yeah, then in his later writing, he just denies what he affirms, earlier on. So
you can see why it's a pretty intractable problem when you're trying to make someone both an omniscient, perfect God who already knows the outcome in every situation, and at the same time, a fallible human, or potentially fallible human. This is one thing.
Yeah.
And how does that person, God, know stuff? It's a tricky one, right?
Framed in such a way where it's infallibly fallible, except not in the way that implies like a defect of nature, given these conditions.
You have to leave that door open for, in theory, fallibility, because otherwise he's not really human. Okay.
But and at the same time, in such a way that, it's not possible, even though it is possible, but the nature, the fulfillment of human nature, that, it would be as if Adam hadn't sinned in the first place, or if he had already like made the right decision, that framing. But that's an example, all to say, if here's someone like Maximus following his logic, regardless of the other side, basically,
right,
going back to the political unity issue versus, for Maximus, more the, you could say, logical, theological unity, even if it means disagreeing with everyone around him, including himself.
Right. So this brings us to Maximus's debt to the philosophical tradition that has come before. There is, in our period, a very active, before our period, going back to early Christian intellectuals, but I would say especially taking off with the Cappadocian fathers, who have become by this point shining canonical examples of all that's good about Greek philosophical techniques wedded to Christian theology, whereby you're doing philosophy. Not all Christians are doing philosophy, And there's a lot of Christians who are still, who think the whole thing reeks of paganism and is, should be, you know, it's Hellenic, it's bad. But there's a whole canonical group of fathers by now who are doing this sort of thinking. So he's very much a philosopher, right? And I'd like to come back to that in terms especially of the legacy of Platonist stroke Aristotelian philosophy coming out of Alexandria. But before we do that, could you just give us a little rundown of, you've referred a few times to writings of Maximus, and he wrote a mountain of material. I don't want you to go through a whole list of every work attributed to him, but if you could tell us the kinds of stuff he wrote, you know, some notable standout works, so we just get a picture of this guy's output, because that's going to help put flesh on the bones.
What we mostly know with like the popular stuff with Maximus would be his exegetical works. And so, for example, the philosophical material, then most people look at the ambigua difficulties addressed to Thomas and to John.
So what are they're sort of exegetical. Here's a problem scripture presents us with. How do we solve the problem? Here's an exposition. Is that the sort of genre?
Yeah, so generally for the exegetical and the ambigua, it's addressed to difficulties on different parts of Gregory Nazianzen's texts or different passages from Gregory's texts where it's explicitly responding to philosophical difficulties. That's how it's set in the ambigua. There is one exception with ambiguum 4, I think, which is that's the one addressed to the Pseudo-Dionysius texts about the one new theandric activity of Christ's human and divine activity. And of course, there Maximus trying to defend against taking that as a monergist reading or monothelitizing reading, and so trying to make a kind of monophysite Dionysius into a deophysite, you know, two nature, two will sort of figure. That's one example where it's looking at texts from church fathers, mainly Gregory Nazianzen and then the Pseudo-Dionysius. And then there are a few other texts. Most of them are addressed to scriptural questions or difficulties, like the questions and doubts, questions et dubia, and then the questions to Thalassius. And the questions to Thalassius, that's another place where you see a lot of philosophical exegesis or in between explaining these different scriptural texts and difficulties. That's also where you could categorize the scholia to the scholia on the Pseudo-Dionysius, at least that's in the manuscript tradition that's ascribed to Maximus. Although, as we were talking earlier, I think most people think that that's basically what's been now identified with John of Scythopolis, at least most of the material.
Yeah.
Although there may be like some amount that might be from Maximus, but most of that's probably coming from John of Scythopolis.
Yeah. As we were also discussing earlier, let's quickly take a little detour down the Pseudo-Dionysius route here, because if you were looking for the significance of Maximus in the history of Western esotericism, you could make the argument that if there were nothing else about him that's significant, what is significant is that regardless of who wrote the scholia, they end up under his name. His name ends up being an absolute gold standard for Chalcedonian orthodoxy and like high-end theology. Like, we love this guy, right? Mm-hmm. And we also love him for his what's often called Christian mysticism, sort of in a monastic context, which we'll get back to. So he's great. So the fact that he gives the imprimatur to Pseudo-Dionysius means Pseudo-Dionysius is legit from now on, right? So that in itself is really significant, regardless of what he actually wrote. But as you say, he definitely at least engaged with the Pseudo-Dionysian text once or twice.
Yeah. I can briefly add to the inscription for Maximus with the scholia. That's the transmission route by which Dionysius and Maximus becomes popular for the Latin West. It's kind of like a similar case of the so-called Theology of Aristotle or the Liber de Causis, which is published under Aristotle's name. Once the Latins figure out that that's actually Proclus, they don't care because they still think, okay, this still fits in with the Aristotelian oeuvre anyway.
Right.
And it's the same thing with Maximus's description, basically. And so it's through the scholia, regardless of the authorship, that's how Dionysius becomes popular for the Latin West. Mm. And then for the East Roman Byzantine world, you already have the Maximian collection that gives approval to the figure of Dionysius, definitely.
Okay. What else do we want to say about his writings before we move on to matters more philosophical?
You also have the letters, Maximus's letters, something like 45 to a ton of different figures that he was aware of. It was in correspondence with so various bishops, abbots, monks, imperial officials, and then between different locations. So that's another indication where we know that Maximus traveled around quite a lot. And that gives maybe some credence to the Greek life of Maximus that says that he was born to imperial officials in Constantinople. You can still make some explanation of that for the Syriac life where, I mean, I didn't mention that earlier. The Syriac life says that Maximus was born in Palestine to a Samaritan merchants and a Persian slave wife, something like
okay.
that.
Okay, so you, low
things
origins.
Like that, you wonder if that's maybe a bit polemical.
Yeah.
But that would give us at least, in some ways, a more convenient explanation for how Maximus knows Sophronius in Jerusalem, because he was already in Palestine and then,
right.
probably, and then had his origins in one of the monasteries in Palestine there. They're the ascetic spiritual texts, like the ascetic life, the four centuries on love. It's set up like the four centuries, it's set up kind of like the Evagrius, Evagrian corpus.
Yeah,
like
we talked about the genre.
Aphorisms.
Sorry to interrupt. We talked about the genre of the centuries with Joel Calvismaki when we talked about Evagrius Opuntus. So this is a sort of aphoristic genre wherein you have 100 aphorisms, right?
Yes,
hence
exactly.
the name centuries. Mm-hmm. And hence the troubling question of where is the 100th century of Evagrius. It's probably esoteric. Mm. But so he wrote centuries as well. Cool.
Yes, exactly. It's still following in that milieu. So, I mean, that tells you it was a tradition. And, you know, this thing is we just have the surviving text. There may have been other collections of centuries between Evagrius, Maximus, and perhaps later. You have that. There's also the centuries on theology and economy. A sort of dogmatic, basically dogmatic text, similar milieu, but giving you kind of aphoristic sayings on like different dogmatic positions or church positions. But also there too, that's where you also find some really interesting, you could say vaguely platonically inspired texts, like for example, the ascription of beginning, middle, and end to God, and then God transcends beginning, middle, and end. So you can see that coming out of the Dionysian milieu in turn going back to, you know, the later Neoplatonic reading of the Parmenides going into those texts.
Right.
So that's one other example. And then finally, you've also have like another set of dogmatic texts like the Opuscula Theologica Polemica. It's not the same as the centuries genre per se, but there you also get some basic, like it's kind of closer to like a list of definitions for different theological terms like nature, hypostasis, and some other dogmatic points. And then this disputation with Cyrus, Disputatio cum Cyro, which there's still some dispute in the literature, is that from Maximus or one of Maximus's followers or someone after, or maybe a combination of hands, that's kind of a recent position. There's a sort of set up dialogue or dispute with Cyrus, who was a patriarch of Constantinople, and then at some point fled Constantinople to Carthage, where this event happened. And that's where Cyrus is convinced of his error with of maintaining the monothelite position. And so that's basically, I guess, it's kind of tracked as a late work where you see Maximus's developed position on, and that's where you see where Christ for Maximus has only a natural will, not gnomic will, for example. But I think there you can sort of see, well, that tracks with more or less Maximus's final position. And also like you see him talk about the virtues as well and other aspects that connects with maintaining that Christ has two wills instead of one will.
Hmm. Okay. So that's a big body of work. What about this text, the Mystagogia?
Yes, and I forgot. Yeah, that's you could also class that under like mystical liturgical texts, mostly Mystagogia, and there's also this other text, the Computus Ecclesiasticus, like on church feast day calculations, Byzantine versus Alexandrian calendars. Yeah, the Mystagogia. Basically, it's an analysis. It's similar to the ecclesiastical hierarchy of, you know, the Pseudo-Dionysius.
Yeah.
In some ways, that's also where you see him really tapping into the Dionysian vein and using a proving of Dionysius, like the Pseudo-Dionysius authority, connecting the church, like the hierarchical levels in the church to the hierarchical levels, the divine level.
Right.
And so participation within that framework is connecting you with the divine. And it's interesting putting that text within the broader background between Maximus's monastic backgrounds. There's a book I've been going through recently by Phil Booth called Crisis in Empire or Crisis of Empire, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And like his reading of Maximus is kind of within this broader milieu, Palestinian monastics like Sophronius and John Moschus, where until then monastics were kind of the separate weird, you know, they were kind of like the separate offshoots. Like they're affirmed, but there wasn't like a view of putting them in a really strong connection with the church or church hierarchy. And this is where you see a turn with this group represented by a text like the Mystagogia with Maximus, where actually Maximus is saying, even for the ascetics, one's participation within the divine life involves, you know, going through these liturgical practices and within the broader hierarchy of the church. And it brings us back to Proclus, Iamblichus, and that strand of later Neoplatonism, I think.
Right, right. In terms of the understanding of divine ritual, its relationship with God stroke the gods, and how by it's important to be doing it because you're sort of conforming life down here to its higher models, the celestial worlds, which will sort of allow God's power to be channeled into our world, right? On the social side, the situation with monasticism, and I know this is a huge topic that's not really in your bailiwick, but it's very interesting to me. Maybe you have some insights here. It seems like if you are Constantinople or if you are the church, you're in a bit of a bind with the monks, because they're the really intense, hardcore Christians, especially, I mean, we know this from the Syriac monastic literature, right? But also from Greek and even polyglot monastic, like, you know, the sort of Mar Saba monastery is producing texts to the highest caliber and doing translations and this sort of very sort of high-end scholarship, and also wearing stinky hair shirts and eating nothing but bread and water and doing all this kind of hardcore ascetic practice at the same time. It's easy for that sort of milieu to get out of control, out of central control. It's a hothouse environment. No one is having sex, so they're very like highly strung. It's all men. I mean, there's women doing this stuff as well, but they don't get a look in terms of this sort of forming of canonical authority. And most importantly, in late antiquity, maybe most importantly, we see that normal everyday Christian folks look up to these athletic, ascetic scholar monks as sources of divine power, right? Like Simeon Stylites is the most iconic example. He sort of stood on a column for decades, and everyone would come from miles around to flock to him to get his advice on all sorts of manners, and also just to sort of soak up his blessing, because he is a sight of God's presence on earth, right? Now, so these people have authority potentially, and it can be out of control. It can be an authority that just emerges from the monastery, and Constantinople's not really there to make sure that everything they say is orthodox and so on, right? So the church has to manage monasticism. Monasticism is kind of like an unruly, esoteric institution in the church that they can't get rid of, but they really would maybe like to be able to have more control over. I mean, you see this again and again in East Roman history. We're going to see unruly monks coming out from the monastery and kicking ass and taking names from time to time in East Roman politics. Is that power dynamic relevant to Maximus? Because Maximus is a monk, is he not?
Yeah, and I think this is where the Syriac life has some credence as far as the Palestinian origin, because then you can see it tying together both the intellectual backgrounds. You can tell that Maximus really knows his texts, the curriculum, coming straight from a lot of it from Alexandria, and between that and the Dionysian corpus, and maybe bits of Proclus, like he's reading directly that you don't find in the Dionysian corpus, and that may be through the Alexandrian route. Right. But between that combined with the intense flavor of monasticism, I mean, I really think the Palestinian origin story really has credence, at least through that angle. So in that sense, I think you it really makes more sense to look at him in that light. It's harder to see him as just coming out of Constantinople, birth raised there, and then like his monastic origin story in Constantinople also, that comes out of the Greek life. I think though, when you put him together, like the way you see him acting, the way you see him like interacting, and also really not bending to the imperial Constantinopolitan will, imperial and patriarchal, then I think it makes more sense than putting him within the Palestinian and Near Eastern milieu more directly.
Okay, so he is a firebrand monk, wandering monk, going around, engaging in disputes, writing a load, and getting into trouble now and again. I'd like to talk to you about his debts to philosophic, late philosophic Platonism that might not come from Gregory of Nyssa, Gregory Nazianzus, the pseudo-Dionysius, but from commentaries on Aristotle by, you know, Olympiodorus or the works of Proclus or whatever. Mm. But before we get to that, I feel like there's a loose end here. Can you explain in as brief a way as is humanly possible what the kind of monothelitite controversy is all about? So keen listeners are aware that there's this one natures, two natures debate that's been going on forever in the Eastern Mediterranean. It's kind of been a major fault line, even in politics in the Eastern Empire. You have monophysites or miaphysites on the one hand, who argue that Christ has a single nature. And then you have the what becomes the Orthodox official position, the so-called Chalcedonian position, which is, no, he has two natures, human and divine, somehow united, right? That's been going on for more than 100 years, 200 years, however long. What is this next like wrinkle in it? The monothelite controversy. You've already kind of alluded to it, but I think we need like the four dummies explanation of what's at stake here.
Yeah. General summary is the position sort of comes up as a way to compromise between the Chalcedonian, or what becomes the Orthodox position, and the monophysite position to have some concrete way to identify the unity of the hypostasis of Christ, the person of Christ, divine and human. So for them, it's basically, let's just say it's initially one activity, one operation between the two. There's no distinction. That becomes then one will, one stronger way to express that unity. So there's still one will between the human and divine nature in such a way that you still have the unity of the person by just one will without making a distinction, which is what you see in Maximus, between the faculty, like the rational appetites or the wills of distinct faculty of the soul versus what's chosen. Basically, that's their way of putting a concrete plaque on the unity tied together, Christ, human and divine, separate natures, by saying that there's one will. At least, yes, like addressing your question there.
Well, you have to find a way to bring it together somewhere, right? So if you've given up on saying they're ontologically one thing, you've decided, no, there's a human nature and a divine nature, and they're somehow united. So there's a split at the ontological level. You have to find a way to bring a unity at some other level. So you could see like energeia, this Aristotelian concept of the playing out of two dynames, two powers or potentials, one human, one divine, they play out in a single energeia, which is like the fulfillment of that. And that's Christ's life on earth and his whole human divine story. That's one way you could do it. Another way you could do it is through saying he has a single will. And from that will, he acts. He's not like divided. He's not like, you know, God part is thinking this and human part is thinking, no, but this. It's like, no, he's single-minded in his pursuit of being the theandric savior. Is that the move?
Yeah. Well, the way that Maximus responds to that, especially the later writings, he uses the Garden of Gethsemane example to show, basically they show like there you can find a real manifestation of this distinction between two faculties of will. Christ expressing, you know, let this cup pass from me, as a way of expressing the human natural desire for self-preservation and self-existence. The faculty of will affirming one's desire for self-existence or self-preservation on the one side, and then his whole, not my will, but your will be done. I guess he takes that in a kind of literal way, as far as like, not my human natural will, but your divine will, that is, you know, the Christ's divine faculty of will, kind of making that like an explicit sort of aligning of the two. And I guess the monothelite position would basically say that that's just a phantasm. This may be a better way to put that, but it's basically like a kind of, that's kind of a mirage. There's no real distinction happening in that event.
Right.
And I think Maximus is trying to say, no, there's something real there. Hmm. But then he has a way to explain that in Aristotelian terms, distinguishing between two faculties of will, but one tropos, one node. So that's always he's able to say, you still have a unity there, but that's in terms of the decision made between the two faculties of will. That's what unites the two together with one mode or one tropos. And that's where you have also the mode of willing and also the mode of existence. Christ had one mode of existence, even though it was two natures.
Right. It's interesting. He's making a kind of a move that reminds me a little bit of Spinoza. who's saying that.
No, yeah, you see, once you start saying modes, and if you have some medieval, early modern knowledge, you cannot get away from the modal language.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely, there's probably some connection for sure. How much does that modal language figure into the Latin world? That's still an open question. And I actually have a colleague from Leuven now in Paris who has a long-term project on that, just the whole history of modalism and medieval, early modern, back to late antiquity.
Brilliant. Okay, so thank you for that summary. I feel like, I guess I understand enough of this monothelite versus diophthalite controversy to be getting on with. It isn't, I think, essential to the history of Western esotericism per se, but it's essential for understanding Maximus. Let's talk about the legacy of late antique philosophy in Maximus's work. As I said before, there's already a lot of philosophy in high-end Christian intellectual thinking. You need look no further than the Cappadocian Fathers. And the Pseudo-Dionysius, as we've seen, is almost a calquing of aspects of late Platonism, post-Proclean, maybe even Damascian Platonism onto a Christian structure and creating this new thing. What is the state of research and what's your own findings on in terms of what Maximus is reading or familiar with from the philosophical tradition outside of the Christian tradition?
I mean, yeah, I've looked at a couple specific angles on this. I mean, I've not really done a systematic survey, and that's something that still is a massive desideratum, even though there's a ton of secondary literature with Maximus and different philosophical aspects, but there hasn't really been a good study of like what exactly is he getting from the Alexandrian curriculum and the Aristotelian and, you know, Proclean Neoplatonic or Proclean Athenian backgrounds. But I had an article 3-4 years ago, the language of the, you know, the logos, like the so-called, what's known as the so-called doctrine of the logoi that she gets in like one ambiguous text, Ambiguum 7. That's where he tries to defend Gregory Nazianzen from becoming an originist. There's a kind of originizing reading of Nazianzen because he has this whole line about that we were parts of gods, we slipped down, and this life that we have is, it's therapeutic, basically. It's a cleansing, purification. And, well, it's hard not to say, okay, he's just a straight-up originist here. That is saying that the soul pre-existed with God and then bodies were created as a result of human sin and the fall. And then, yeah, basically, this life is meant as a purification from that sin in the first place. So he tries to make a distinction between, on the one hand, the soul is something created with the body, and then on the other hand, well, there is something that pre-exists, creation of human bodies, but that isn't the soul. That would be, but basically enter pretty much the logoi, that is reasons. You could say something similar to, my reading is something similar to like Augustine's notion of the rationalis seminalis, principles by which humans and every kind of created being, but what its original nature and intention is, that existed with God. And of course, he brings that together with the logos, the person of the logos, and or Christ. He has that whole, like, kind of the famous line that the one logos is the many logoi, and the many logoi one logos. So he identifies or connects the different principles that belong to each type of being, created being, and each individual with the person of the word, with the person of the logos. Basically, I had this article looking at how much the way he's talking about the logoi as manifestations of the logos, and then the way that he also talks about providence in this context, a lot of it sounds very familiar if you read Proclus, especially the distinction and the relation between the one and the henads, basically many manifestations of the one. And they're also principles by which each of them is a measure or also a kind of like a logos as well for each type of being. And of course, if you know your Neoplatonic terminology, logos is more at the level of like nature, you know, the level soul instead of like at the upper level. I think you see Maximus kind of following this sort of collapse of these different levels. On the one hand, like that you see in Dionysius, in one sense, there's not like a strict hierarchy of different principles, but in a way there is between God at the top level, and then you have like gods and then intellects and souls. But then again, he does retain some of that. And then this is where you can see the Pseudo-Dionysian background coming in with the angels that kind of take the place of these different separate causes or principles that you get in later Neoplatonism, especially with Proclus. Which is all to say, so yeah, I think that's one example where you see him applying some of this way of talking about the henads from Proclus they're manifestations of the one in the same way that the logoi are kind of manifestations of the logos, the person of the logos, as intentions or principles for each kind of being. Those are the things that pre-exist creation and each created being on the one hand. And then he also has that language about so long as every person aligns with that logos, his particular logos as the kind human, or even the logos that belongs to a specific person like Socrates, that's where one has that reunification or basically union with God, with the divine that way.
Right.
That's where you see a similar connection to Neoplatonism.
That's really interesting because it also allows you to make sense of the fact that the logos, i.e. Christ, in the Gospel of John, is the creator deity, right? He's everything that was made through him. So meaning what? Well, he's the logos. He contains all the logoi, and everything that exists has its particular ousia. I assume he's using this Aristotelian all-purpose term, ousia, like the thing that makes it what it is, its essence, because of the particular logoi that gave rise to it. So they're all pre-existing in Christ. So Christ is this sort of universal world of forms, actually.
Yeah, paradigmatic forms.
Right.
That's the thing. Yeah, and I think that's where you find that distinction, and also it goes back to the Neoplatonism connection here also, like the distinction between the form itself, you know, the intellect or the intelligible, and then there's the enmattered form that is like at the level of like the immaterial being, especially if you follow Iamblichus and that brand of later Neoplatonism that is happy to accept Aristotle's story with enmattered forms for each individual thing, but that's in alignment with one paradigm. And that's, I think, what you see being played out with Maximus in responding to this Origenist reading. There's another thing we haven't talked on yet, but it's another major background issue is with Maximus's Origenism.
Right.
It still continues. It becomes a major, still an issue for 6th, 7th century monastics and people.
Yeah. So it's certainly, I would correct me if I'm wrong here, because I don't know any of this background, but my guess would be it's impossible for Maximus to come out and say, actually, Origen was right, because he's been condemned and his ism has been condemned roundly, various councils and various very authoritative works of anti-Originist polemic have been, you know, sort of brought into the mainstream. But that doesn't mean he can't, on the sly, or maybe even without knowing it, actually agree with a lot of Origen's teachings, right?
Yeah, it's a complicated story there also. How much is he explicitly, implicitly, consciously, or subconsciously affirming or rejecting Origen or Origenism? And also how much of this is like a broader issue for like the monastic community that he's connected with. And I think that they all are using Origen in some way, in some level, as much as also they're kind of having to selectively or openly, in some cases, like with this Maximus text, like reject, okay, you really can't take this pre-existence line at all. But what's interesting, there's a kind of development you see with like these Origenists still trying to say that all these souls existed. The way that Maximus reconstructs his position after giving the quote from Gregory, he has this line about all souls. Like there are these people who follow this position that all souls were in one henad. Actually, interesting. He does use the word henad or henas. It's pretty sure not Proclus, but you can't help but wonder. There's some connection.
He says
this henad was connatural.
You do find the term henas, I believe, in Gregory of Nyssa as well. Mm-hmm. So it's around in Christian theology in a non-Proclean, or, you know, at least at one remove from Proclus.
Yeah, there's a study by Polycarp Sherwood from the 50s where he tries to find other textual references to this henas ton logikon in the Greek, so this henad of rational beings. I mean, there is a text right after Origen that has some connection to Origen, but what survives in the De Principiis on first principles of Origen, it's not clear if it's actually there. Which is all to say there's probably some development after Origen of this kind of position, but you can see all to say basically there's this development of this position of a kind of development of this idea of the pre-existence, all beings had their pre-existence before their bodily birth. It's still a popular position in these monastic circles and other circles. And you can see that Maximus is trying to say you can't really argue that at all. That's especially comes at the end of this text where he adamantly says you cannot logically hold a position of the soul's pre-existence. It seems like there's another position in the background not just that there's a pre-existence of souls, but that there are bodies that pre-exist the soul coming to be. Some people think there's this anti-originist movement that, in so rejecting this like idea that souls must pre-exist bodily birth, the kind of mainstream Platonist take, they say that, well, actually, the body is actually, they take this proto like or quasi Stoic reading of bodies actually have rationality in them, and the soul only has its, well, the soul does have a separate being for them, but any activity it exercises is only through the body. Yeah. So once the body passes away, then the soul is just totally inert. And then when you get to the resurrection, when the bodies come to be, that's when the soul is able to exercise its activities right. again.
So that's how you bridge the gap between death and the resurrection. The soul exists qua existence, yeah. but it can't do anything until it gets rebodied in the spiritual body that you get in the resurrection.
Exactly. Got it. Yeah, yeah. Or in one of these letters, he says that these people would say that the body that comes back is exactly the same body that you have now. That includes all the processes of corruption, like, you know, the need for digestion, for continuing to keep things together, but somehow it doesn't pass away. And actually, that's where you do see Maximus say that that's not the body that will come back. It will have to be a different... That's where you see him kind of playing back and forth with the kind of originist, like spiritual body, the kind of pneumatic vehicle idea on the one side. And then on the other side, he also has, there are other places in the text where he seems to take up Gregory Nyssa's line that all the elements that are in the current corruptible body will come back into their same configuration altogether. But what that configuration is itself would be something different in the next resurrected life in a way that's, whatever the processes of that body will not imply corruption.
Right.
So that's all a long-winded way of saying in this letter, where you see Maximus addressing this other weird position with the resurrection body having all these corruptible processes. He says, no, it has to be something different. This is the same people would say that the soul sleeps basically between death and the resurrection. So he's like managing these two sides, so to say.
Right, yeah. I wonder what you think of this, because looking at Origen's take on the resurrection body in What Survives of Origen, and we know that Origen was accused at a council of having taught a spherical resurrection body, and people who want to save Origen for orthodoxy say he definitely didn't teach that. I'd say that the evidence is inconclusive, because if he didn't teach it, some follower of him must have been teaching it, because... otherwise, where did this notion come up that this is an Originist teaching? So maybe some Originist monks were teaching it. But anyway, it's the kind of thing that you might, as a Platonistically influenced, educated Christian, want to come up with. Because you've got little to go on. You've got the Pauline epistles where he talks about a pneumatikon soma, like a spirit body.
Mm-hmm.
And then... You know that the resurrection body has to be immortal. It has to have, you know, various qualities of excellence. What is that? Well, for someone trained in a Platonist way of thinking, it's like, well, obviously it's going to be spherical because that is the best shape. Mm-hmm. And we know that the motions of the nous and the soul are spherical, and the cosmos is spherical, and so on and so forth. That's a long-winded way of getting to the point I wanted to make, which is, everything Origen actually says about what the resurrection body is going to be like, what the resurrection is going to be like, the whole teaching of the resurrection, he says this is a very deep matter that is very hard to understand. He says a bunch of stuff that deflects from actually coming out and saying it. And my take is that he even in one place says, this is a very easy matter for the unlettered Christians to get wrong. All of this to me points to a kind of esoteric, like there is a teaching on this perhaps, but it's not something I'm going to write about because it's too easy for people to misunderstand it. In other words, this is an esoteric teaching at the heart of Christianity that you might want to have an outer teaching, which is just maybe quoting the Bible and saying it's going to be glorious resurrection. And then an inner teaching where we actually philosophically dig into what it's going to be like. One can imagine monks sitting around in the old monastery getting into that esoteric inner teaching and coming up with all manner of speculations. But my question for you is, do you think Maximus is also treating this in a way where he's careful about what he can say and maybe holds certain positions that he's not going to come out and actually lay his cards on the table about? Speculative question, maybe.
Well, it's interesting. You kind of see this position he reconstructs from these weird guys who hold that the soul sleeps between the death and the resurrection. His response to those people with like their idea of the corruptible body and that's resurrected, he says, well, okay, it's not going to be that. What's resurrected is something that is going back to the original nature, thusis and ousia, of the body. That's something that, interestingly, doesn't seem like we have now, actually. So we have a kind of incomplete, I mean, that's my fill-in, or my take is, from this text, you seem to have a kind of incomplete sort of notion of body. That there's a completion that we don't have right now, that we would have, like, what's resurrected is coming back to the original ousia, or nature, or substance and nature of body, he says in that text. But what that is, we don't know at all.
Okay.
And he says, it's best to keep to silence.
Boom.
I think he says literally. And that's where you find, okay, that's an interesting parallel back to Origen there. This is something that epistemologically we have no access to, so it's better to keep pious reverence and silence. And there, maybe you could still see, maybe there's a little bit of an esoteric strain there, perhaps. Maybe if this is some kind of higher, maybe it's a higher understanding, which is going beyond, you know, the level of intellect, for example. But I forgot this. Maybe one thing I should have mentioned earlier too, but in places like Ambigium 7 and other places, he has another connection with Proclus, is basically union happens with God beyond both the level of discursive reasoning, but also beyond the level of noesis or nous. So it says that the way that the soul comes into union with God is by kathenosin, something else, but it is according to unity. Oh, simple unity, he says, henosin. So that's, another tie back to Proclus there as well.
Well, that brings us to the last sort of major aspect of Maximus's thought that I wanted to talk to you about. And I'm really glad we've at least filled in some details of our picture of his thought and his work in order to approach this most difficult thing, which is apophatic discourse. The Pseudo-Dionysius is the prince of Christian apophatism, maybe. He coins a whole new vocabulary of alpha privative adjectives to describe how you can't describe God. He goes on at length about how he can't go on at length about God. He very much expends a lot of paradoxical energy on placing the subject of his discourse, God, outside of discourse. How does Maximus carry that on? Because you've already alluded to a few places, interestingly to me, where Maximus's complex philosophical speculations about pre-existence in Christ and stuff like this can lead to very suddenly a switch from the ratiocinative mode of discourse to a kind of unitary mystical realization that through the theandric activity we are Christ in some way, right? There's some mysticism going on here, if we're going to use that term in its normal kind of Christian meaning. What does Maximus do here? Tell us about this, because I feel like Maximus is really important as a approved orthodox expounder of God's unknowability.
Yeah, I mean, maybe a slight clarification just beforehand is, when Ori kind of gets this in the Cappadocian Fathers, like Gregory of Nyssa's whole thing about God as like an infinite sea of being that shows up in a couple places. On the one hand, but at the same time, on the other hand, the strong emphasis on God as beyond being, in such a way though that, it's going beyond what you're getting with Nyssa, where, okay, God is an infinite sea of being, but there's still, I mean, it's similar to like the anonymous Parmenides commentary, where he, distinguishing between the one and being in terms of, well, it's like pure being, pure activity and so on, and then it's limited at the level of being, like, leaving that aside, but that's where you can definitely see the legacy of, you could say, a kind of Periclean or, later Neoplatonist construal of describing the, the first cause or God in terms like cataphatic and apophatic. You see, basically, I think mostly read Maximus a similar way to, like, he's in various places happy to just accept Dionysius' framing of equally applying cataphatic and apophatic terms to God. God is as much paradigmatically being itself, life itself, all these other divine perfections, as much as he's beyond all those things at the same time. But then there are some passages in Maximus where he's actually more happy to just stick with a sort of quasi kind of Proclean line where actually God in himself, if you're describing God unqualifiedly, you cannot apply the divine names there. There's one passage, I had an article on a while ago, and this is in the Censius of Theology, like book 1, 48 to 50, where he seems to just straight up copy Proclus's distinction of God is just unparticipated in himself. And then there's the works of God that are outside time, by which we see these perfections like infinity, being, and like various other perfections. And then there are beings that God created in time, which participate in those works outside time, by which God has participated, but God himself is beyond all those things. So it's weird because that's not something I think you see anywhere in the Dionysian Corpus, more or less like just saying that God is not any of these perfections as such. But then there are other passages in the same text where he just accepts the Dionysian just conflation of the two together at the same time.
Right.
That's where I think you may find something, you're finding something that's not just in the Dionysian Corpus, and that's where I wonder, is he reading Proclus directly or indirectly if it's filtered through, say, these Alexandrian Platonist texts? And that's, I think, one possibility that still, I think, hasn't really been, as far as I know, hasn't really been looked at, just tracing that lineage. But that's where you do see, in some ways, if you take that line, like where he just identifies God with the unparticipated, as you see in Proclus with the one, in some ways it's kind of even more apophatic than what you get in Dionysius, where Dionysius accepts that you can both equally affirm and deny the same predicates of the subjects, conflating the first and the second hypothesis.
Raising the stakes of transcendence another notch. It does seem like there's a sort of transcendence arms race in some of this late antique theological stroke philosophical work. Like you go from Plotinus's one, formerly ineffable, but we can say an awful lot about it, even though we have to hedge and say hoion a lot, and to Iamblichus going, no, that one, there's another one beyond that, which is even more ineffable. And then all the way down to Damascius, who's like, there's this entity that's a not entity, and we're just going to call it the ineffable. We're just going to name it that to just underline that we cannot say anything about it. There's all these approaches, and something the Pseudo-Dionysius, I think, maybe kind of invented or was an innovator in, is to go down that route of simultaneous apophatic and cataphatic reasoning and pronouncements, which could be seen as a kind of performative text, right? Like the effort of reading about God and both understanding God as perfection, being, life, and also understanding God at the same time as none of those things, because all those things are limited concepts that are not applicable. It's like a category error to even use them. To hold both of those in the same mental space creates a kind of weird inner explosion. And maybe the point from a performative monastic context perspective is to foster that kind of explosion and just stop the and then maybe that's where the henosis comes in. I don't know, I'm theorizing, I'm sort of dreaming about this because I'm not a Christian monk, but it seems like if you're looking for henosis, if you're looking for divinization, which a Maximus is, right, maybe part of that in its higher echelons is a kind of very thorough rinsing out of philosophic categories and stuff to, if not get at God with your mind, because you can't, at least stop with all the chatter about God, because you've just like absolutely put it to bed through this sort of dialectic of cataphatic and apophatic head fuck. Does that make sense?
Oh no, that's definitely tracking. And I mean, I think you see it as a common, I think, common milieu at this point. And that's where you wonder how much is Maximus, in this case, is he coming up with this stuff by himself, or is this part of a broader conversation within the monastic circles that he's connected with, if there are already trends in this direction? I lean in that direction, I think.
Right.
What you see with the author, like the author of the text that we read, for example, doing, like, there is something interesting where he's trying to set these boundaries and limits in terms of Aristotelian terms and language, which, I mean, that's where I would read the Alexandrian Platonist line coming through. It's that kind of later post-Proclus approval of Aristotle entirely with Plato and Platonism, and you can put one and the other together, partly that. So at the same time, maybe going back to just what you were saying earlier, with putting these different like cataphatic, apathetic terms together, I think also in that sense, I think insofar as he's following Pseudo-Dionysius here, he's basically just expanding on a common view with Proclus, like with the way that Proclus talks about the henads, where then same kind of dynamic there, where you have one and the same attribute affirmed and denied of each henad, qua clause of whatever class of being, you affirm all those different predicates of it, but qua unity or qua one, then you deny all those predicates at the same time. So on the one hand, because there it's a cause of all those things, it is put in the second hypothesis. I keep confusing hypothesis and hypothesis a lot when talking about
fatal
the
error, but easy to make at this in this sort of metaphysics.
Yeah, exactly. All to say, they have this intermediate kind of ontological status or category between the love of the one, which you have pure negations that comes from the first hypothesis. You know, this is coming from Plato's Parmenides, and then the second hypothesis where you have all the affirmations of being, and then the causes of all those affirmations that are fully manifested at, you know, the level of intellect or being. I've basically kind of followed this line you see with people like Tim Riggs and some others with Dionysius, where he's just saying that what you have with those henads, that's just basically the Christian God and such. Forget about the one as like this totally separate hypothesis. You basically have one the same God, just one God, but basically described as a henad, which actually that's where I think you might see some more Damascius there, because he describes the one in the same way. The one is all things, but also because it is the cause of all things, it is beyond all things. And so you can't really relate one with the other in literal terms together, but because it causes those things, then you can relate it together. And I think that's where that you also see a similar kind of two things put together, the cataphatic right. and apophatic. Same thing kind of happens before Damascus with the one after the ineffable. So you still have to deal with the ineffable, whatever happens with that, with Dionysius and
you
Maximus.
Don't, because you can't, but, right? It's not to be
exactly.
dealt with.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that's where you can find the broad conceptual lineage from Proclus to Damascus, then to Dionysius. And I think Maximus just falling in line there with Dionysius, except somehow he's still happy to take that unparticipated, participated distinction in some places like this text and those entries on theology and economy.
Right. I guess we should emphasize here maybe on the concrete level how much the sort of teaching activity at Alexandria, we know, although we sort of declared it dead with Olympiodorus in a certain way, it isn't dead. There's these figures we don't know much about, people like Elias and David still writing Aristotelian commentaries mostly, but still writing, and we know there's still teaching going on in Alexandria. And it's teaching in this sort of late polytheist synthesis of Aristotle and Plato and Platonism, this, what you might call the last gasp of classical philosophy in a certain way, in an academic formal context, it's just segued into the Christian era. And it's still going on until, I guess, the Arab invasions. Maybe it still kind of goes on. Mm-hmm. But there's huge, we do know that there's a huge amount of sort of connection between Alexandria and these Near Eastern monasteries. So everything that's being published in Alexandria is making its way into the monastic communities outside of Egypt. And so there's this flow of information, right? So he's very much he's plugged into a living scholarly philosophic network, dealing with Aristotle, dealing with Proclus, dealing with Plotinus, all these guys, but Christian.
Yeah.
So there's the question, to what degree is Christianity a Platonistic religion from the beginning? And I'm not qualified to talk about that, but I would certainly say that from a Maximus onward, I mean, from the Cappadocians onward, really, but from a Maximus onward, Orthodoxy is like just totally imprinted with these late antique Platonist ways of thinking about being, non-being, the sayable, the unsayable, radical transcendence, and how you have a radical transcendence at the heart of all being, while at the same time having a God that, you know, cares for humans and directly intervenes and all this sort of thing, right? Yeah. This is like the pattern. So the pattern of Christianity is late Platonist in this very significant way, right?
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's a lot of times seems like it's either piggybacking, parasitical kind of like influence, or like they basically are picking up things in tandem or just after, at the same time that the context in which this like theoretical activity, like thinking activity, or you could say philosophic activity is happening, it's often within this concrete context, like especially with Maximus, the exegetical works is basically talking to other monastics, other people closely associated with monastics. And then, of course, with the letters, you have some addressed to bishops and others. But it's a very different milieu than, say, when you're in the intellectual circle of like different circles in Alexandria. And that's an interesting context, comparing that with the Athenian Academy, where Alexandria, they just have, it's like a commuter college, I guess, in Alexandria. You have all these different people coming in from different backgrounds, and they're just adapting bits and pieces or wholesale parts of a kind of Platonic curriculum. But that's adapted to different audiences and circumstances, especially in Alexandria. I mean, that's the thing. It always seems like it had that milieu. I don't know how much of this is just... I'm not sure how much of this is just like Ammonius agreeing to just put a cap on the theurgy talk with the Christian patriarch in Alexandria. And or is this just Ammonius himself, where he just has no interest in this stuff, perhaps? But all to say, like, compare that with what happens in Athens with the Platonist Academy. There's a unitary kind of school. The Alexandrian school, it's a bit more scattered, but you still have a kind of intellectual, like, academy people are going to, a kind of quasi commuter college of sorts. Then when you're looking at Maximus and these texts, you see this is, it's just someone in the persona of a monastic talking to other monastics, monastic life basically. And their main point of reference and dispute is issues in the scriptures, and then figuring out what other earlier church authorities were saying, like Gregory Nazianzen. And then you see him bringing in all these different Platonist elements to explain what's happening overall. I think you also see that too with the Cappadocian fathers, like Gregory of Nyssa and Gregory Nazianzen. Although in the case of Nyssa, maybe Nazianzen, but especially Nyssa, he's bringing in other elements beyond just, say, Plotinus and Porphyry, like a lot of Stoic material, for example, and whatnot. And with Maximus, you see him, I think maybe it's easier to read him as just bringing most of the Alexandrian corpus as he's reading this different text and material. So it's weird because it's harder to qualify him as just basically one Christian like David in the circle of Ammonius. It doesn't seem like he's doing what David and Elias are doing as Christians per se, but he's using a lot of the material in that sense. So in that sense, he does kind of copy what they're doing, but the audience, and that's where I think maybe my methodology is reading the text in terms of who they're addressed to, and like you understand like the ideas that are expressed in this milieu or this medium that kind of constrains what exactly they're trying to do with this material and with this background, and then to understand like how Platonist is Maximus in this sense. So in one way, I think still in that sense, I think Carlos Steele, like, he has this line about Maximus as sort of the last great exponents of Platonism in late antiquity, as expressing these ideas, and I think he's totally right. And at the same time, he's an interesting kind of bridge figure, because he's kind of an exponent of Platonism, but in the context of basically a very practical life and trying to give an exposition in defense of like certain orthodox views against other heretics and so on. Interesting, weird intermediary place he occupies in terms of, you could say, Platonist intellectual thought. And that's where I think there's some interesting things to approach or look at Maximus there, rather than, I don't want to go too far down rabbit hole here, but I think until now, most literature that looks at Maximus, it's either from the theology camp that sees Maximus as someone doing something completely new that hadn't happened before on the one side, and then there's the other side that just reads Maximus as just kind of a Christianized megaphone for whatever strain of Alexandrian or Athenian Platonism you have. And I think it's a bit oversimplistic, but something in the middle, because you see him like consciously reusing this material, but in such a way, though, that he's clearly like saying, well, he's not naming Proclus or other Neoplatonists, of course, and this is a common thing with Christian authors. But he is tapping into a line and using these elements to explain Christian elements in this concrete context that is kind of a kind of vehicle of this other, like this whole milieu. That's where I think you can see the Platonist and then the esoteric kind of line, I guess, in that sense, coming through. I'm still figuring out how to think about someone like Maximus in this whole context, but like, that's where I still think you know, there's something interesting to look at with a guy like Maximus.
Jonathan Gregg, on that note, thank you very much for coming on again to the podcast, telling us about this fascinating character, laying out some of the background, but also some of his importance for Western esotericism going forward. If if listeners thought that that kind of hardcore apophatic metaphysics that we saw in, when we covered the late Alexandrian Academy and never mind the Athenian Academy, was dead, no, it is not dead. It has moved firmly and irrevocably into Christianity, but not just moved in, but moved in very specifically in the theological thinking and discussions of this complex and surely somewhat original thinker, Maximus the Confessor, right? I mean, however indebted he is to the traditions in which he is swimming, he's, as you said, he's challenging his own thinking. He's doing the work of trying to figure out how all this scripture and all this philosophy can fit together, how you can give a philosophically coherent account of Christianity. And that just gives rise to his unique voice, I would say, right? And that voice very much will echo down the ages going forward.
Yeah, Michael Solos, for example, the 11th century, he explicitly puts Maximus as saying philosophical content to be measured with Aristotle or other Neoplatonist material. And from that point on, basically, he's taken as a like philosopher, not just as a church father. So yeah,
and I think
it's interesting seeing that.
Yeah, that Solos is a major kind of milestone in the history of high-octane Platonist-style thinking in a Christian context. But of course, even though we don't have any Seloses between Maximus in the 7th century and Selos in the High Middle Ages, there have to have been people thinking along those lines and reading those texts and discussing that kind of material at Constantinople and in maybe in many a monastery in the Eastern Commonwealth throughout that whole period, right?
There's a kind of, you could say, quasi-esoteric line going there between one and the other. It's not explicitly spoken, but there's something, yeah, some transmission's happening in the background, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. On that note, be like the transmission of this apophatic current at the core of exoteric Orthodox Christianity, and stay esoteric.
Thank you again, Errol.